This is an audio recording of a seminar presentation given on December 1, 2009 by Dr. Doug Clough, lecturer in interactive media development at Britain's Open University. Dr. Clough's subject was the ways that scholarly publishing is changing as we move into a digital era. His presentation was part of the regular seminar series organised by the Arcadia Project, which is a three-year programme based at Cambridge University Library to explore the role of research libraries in a digital age. For more information, please visit arcadiaproject.lib.cam.ac.uk.
I'm an academic at the Open University, and my field is, as you said, interactive media development or educational technology broadly. And one of our, my research group has been looking at a strand of work we're calling Researcher 2.0, trying to imagine what it means to be a researcher in a new Web 2.0 environment, not that it's that new anymore. And one strand of that that I got particularly interested in was about scholarly publishing and what's happening there. And the sort of the funny joke about crossing out 2.0 and writing squared is about moving from Web 2.0 to a new, more grounded social web where it meets the real world, social services, semantic services, local services, internet things, all that stuff that you can find out about later. And these slides will all be available online at SlideShare later on. If you, I'm sure John will post a link, or if you search for my name in Arcadia Seminar, I'm sure it'll come up online. I'll almost certainly blog about it as well, so it's easy to find. And the reason it's not on SlideShare yet is because I'm an inveterate last-minute fiddler, so the latest version of it is on this machine and nowhere else. Now, I've encountered my first... Interesting.
Yeah, good.
Right. Now, none of you have been to one of my talks before. I always start off by trying to find, if I don't know the audience, try and guess a little bit about what you already know before I tell you what you already know in a way that convinces you that you didn't already know it. And the rules of this quiz, you're all going to have to put your hand up to one of these options. None of them will fit you precisely. That's the point. You have to pick the one that's closest. And you're only allowed, you must vote, and you must vote for one and one only. You can say, so are you really very technical? Do you know enough about and about this sort of stuff? You've got a vague idea, someone mentioned this, so no idea what you're talking about. If you genuinely don't care about anything, serious, I'm not going to talk. If this is you, you'll probably get some interesting bits that will come up, but I'm not going quite in there. So you're all going to have to put your hands up. Hey, who's up the techie end? Anyone? But, okay, yes. Good, be proud, it's good. We need that stuff. B, the people who know about more or less what they're about. Okay, people who are a little bit more hesitant about some sort of vague idea. People for whom any of these words are new, that's good. And there's the only thing to be ashamed about ignorance is willful ignorance, and you're here listening to me, which is the best place. And those of you who still don't care, now is the time to make the exit before it's too late. I want to do a little bit of historical context, and commercial companies have played a vital role in scholarly publishing over the last 250 years, and this college, in this university, is a good example of understanding that the last 250 years have been exceptional. Things are changing, but scholarly publishing is an old activity. This is St. Jerome in his study in about the 15th century or so. And you can see he's reading books. So it's a sort of study environment. It's very similar to John's little cubbyhole in the back. It's an office environment that a lot of people might recognise. Modern, with a bit of fancy extra bits. A lot, but the bits that are round about him are quite similar, apart from the lack of very new technology. The other a point that some of the university managers make is, look, it's an open plan office. But the riposte to that is, no, he's not. He's got a huge office with a little cubbyhole. There's nobody else in there. You can't just stack these next to each other and expect academics to do the sort of stuff that they usually do. So the last 250 years have been exceptional. The next 25 months are going to be even more exceptional. And with any new scholarly practices, there's new scholarly practices coming in, this reliance on new technology, it leads to people skimming over things, it leads to a lack of depth of understanding, a weakening of the power of the mind. People might seem, with the aid of this new technology, to look like and convince the naive that they know what they're talking about, but actually they don't. It's really a very shallow form of knowledge, and they're not really very clever. That's not someone talking about the web. It's not someone talking about John Murray's publishing. It's actually Socrates talking about resisting the introduction of scholarly publishing way back in ancient Athens, and he was trying to put a stop to it because he thought oral culture was the only way to do anything of real intellectual value. So the point that I'm making here is that there's a long tradition here, and great scholars are often critical of innovation in scholarly practice. They often have a very good point, but they rarely make any profound difference, and they don't stop those sorts of changes. So things are changing. So now, this is a little bit of an outline of what's ahead in the talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about the big changes, and I'll probably skate over that quite quickly because most of you, I think, will have some idea about that. There's some conflicts in the world of scholarly publishing, which I want to argue are a result of an incongruence of incentives between different people who are working there. I have this model of scholarly publishing that helps illustrate that. I want to talk a little bit about new forms of scholarly publishing, and then focus on what really counts. How do we know what's good? And of course, as a good academic, I have to start with interrogating the question and to define what I mean by scholarly publishing, which is a question I entirely dodge by saying that scholarly publishing is what scholars publish, which, if I want to dress it up, is an ethnographic definition of what scholarly publishing is. And scholars are people that other scholars acknowledge as scholars. That sort of reputation thing is fundamental to how you're recognised as a scholar. And scholarly publishing, I like to think of as a distinctive sort of conversation by researchers, and it's characterised by quality. And I'm going to keep coming back to this idea that peer review is a key point in it. And that idea of what it means to publish something is a really interesting point, because going right back to Socrates, where there's something printed and written down that people can take up later, I think that's not a bad definition of it. There's all sorts of... We still talk, though, when we produce journal articles which are wholly online, or we produce electronic books that only ever exist as PDF files, we still talk about them being published, despite the fact that they've been available in all sorts of forms along the way and still are at the end. So, but we still talk about this is the final published version, as if publishing gives it some special magic. I think that's interesting. The big changes. There's lots of big changes going on in the broader world of publishing that affect our little happy world of scholars. You've all seen graphs like this where you've got this is Gordon Moore's law. He predicted that the number of transistors on a chip would double on the scale of about every 18 months or thereabouts. And this scale, just so you're clear, is logarithmic, so it looks like a good graph. Going up in numbers. See the number of transistors on an actual chip. These are actual chips that Intel have produced. So this graph looks impressive. It's on a logarithmic scale, so it actually would shoot well out of the ceiling. And that law affects a lot of electronic devices and things associated with that. So you see huge growth like that rocketing up. And the web is another example of that. There you can see the introduction of the World Wide Web. This is the number of domains on the World Wide Web. We've got one there, which is Tim Berners-Lee's first website, and up to 97 it starts rocketing up. Then that's this little bit of this graph here, is this graph, and it does the same again, although that's the total host names of the active ones, which aren't quite so spectacular. But that sort of rocketing up of technology is the backdrop to changes in the whole publishing world, not just scholarly publishing. And the other big change that's happening, focusing narrower down on us, there's more scholars. There's far more scholars, not just academics, but beyond. There's far more universities now than there was 20 years ago. There's more scholars within those universities, and there's more universities in more countries than there used to be. And each of those scholars is producing, on average, more publications for lots of reasons that we know about. So this expansion of higher education in Britain, the RAE, but there's similar exercises in other countries, that's all producing more and more publications with this backdrop. And just sort of illustrating the technology for printing and actual producing physical technology, physical printed artifacts, is advancing. from this sort of thing, which was a great innovation some time after St. Jerome was painted there, to this, which is a modern multicolour process thing. This, it's gone from something that's sort of you could stick in maybe in the corner of this room, it would take up the whole of this, to it got bigger in between, it's got smaller there down to the full-on thing. Now there's this machine, which is the Espresso book machine, which is now something about the size of this corner of the room. I think it's reasonable to predict that within the next 5 or 10 years that's going to shrink down to the size of something you can have on your desktop, to something that you can produce. And the cost of producing something is print on demand. You just send the file to the printer and it spits out a printed and bound book that would be recognisable to us as a printed and bound book, is dropping right through the floor. It's doing the opposite of that curve taking off. The price per copy is dropping down. So the technology is changing, and that's affecting what's going on in the broad publishing world, and also more narrowly in the scholarly publications world. And this is also... this technology is why people who say the book, the physical book is dead, are wrong, and are just as wrong as the people who said that the PC would usher in the paperless office. Because I remember all the books published that said this, printed books. And they also discussed the great technology of the desktop printer and failed to marry up the two and point out that a desktop printer will produce far more. And we use far more paper now than we ever did before computers were introduced. So this has led to an information explosion of scholarly information. We've got more scholars producing more publications. And Clay Shirky has a good point about how to manage this. There's no such thing as information overload, he says. There's only filter failure. And you need more filters. And actually, this is where there being more scholars is actually helpful, because you've got more scholars, you've got more people available to do the peer review, which is one of the key quality filters. And there's a lot more new and exciting tools around. Some of you might even have made some of these, thinking about it, and I've only picked a few examples. Electronic journals are happenstance. Something that really struck me about the difference that electronic journals have made. I'd cleared out my office, ready to move into an open plan environment, and I had one or two journal runs left on my shelves, which were journals that I consulted very regularly. I wanted to refer to something I knew was sort of about 2005 or something like that, and I knew it was just behind my head there, but it was actually much quicker to type it in, find it, and cut and paste the reference that way than to actually find it on the thing behind me. So those went for recycling. And the Open University Library is moving to all electronic collections wherever we can as a way of saving money and expanding the access to journals. And electronic document delivery, which seems terribly exciting. You think, great, the document delivery service, you can get hold of any journal article that you want, even if your library doesn't have a subscription. Now, increasingly, you'll be able to get that electronically rather than having to have a little bit of paper sent to you in the post. That seems like a great innovation. It's actually what the World Wide Web does without requiring all of that infrastructure in between. But never mind. There's more tools for helping you manage references. There's more tools for searching through things. There's federated search. I'm going to come on to talk about that. There's all sorts of ways of alerting you to the new things that are coming in. So it's very exciting, but if you find the information explosion daunting, you may find the explosion of information management tools also similarly daunting. And you need some librarians to help you with that. So that's an important role for people who know about this stuff and can mediate it for poor dizzy academics like me. Now, here I'm going to come back to Shibboleth. Shibboleth is a federated access management system that implements some aspects of the security assertion markup language to provide cross-domain single sign-on, which means for academics, if your library has paid for you to get hold of journal articles, then you will be able to get at them without it being quite as annoying as it previously was. And so the early library has done this, I'm sure. I don't know whether have you gone that way? Yeah, you have. So we've got this marvellous thing. If you put it into our search engine, our single one-stop search engine, you search across all of the journals that our library has a subscription to, you can see there's about 5,000 hits altogether. 154 of those are actually available to us that you can actually click straight through to, and you can get to those. And this search to complete only took 4 minutes from me sending it. It's fantastic. If you try the same query on Google, instead of 4,000 or 5,000 hits, we've got nearly 14 million, and it took 0.34 seconds to do that. And then a fairer comparison might be Google Scholar, and there actually some of those articles are starting to look relevant to someone who might want to know about scholarly publishing, and that only took 0.2 of a second, and there's 450,000 resources. So all of that effort, and some of you will know the effort involved to make this stuff work, actually doesn't look like that big a deal to academics. You think, well, of course you can do that. It's easy. You ought to be able to do that. And in a way, they're right, because the web is and web native stuff is much better at this. It's not surprising, because the problem that that single federated search is solving is the problem that is close to the problem that Tim Berners-Lee invented the web for in the first place, which was sharing preprints of journal articles. The first website back in 91 or thereabouts, publicly available, had journal article preprints and their technical reports on it. So that it's a huge amount of effort to get over this. And I'll come back to there's a lot of clever stuff that the publishers are doing to keep control of their content. There's lots of clever stuff that the library's doing to enable access to that in the middle. And I'm not sure that that's actually very not wasted effort. And that's because the incentives aren't the same. The incentives for commercial publishers are not always congruent. There's a lot of overlap, and commercial publishers have done fantastic things for scholarly publishing and will continue to do so, but the incentives are not the same. The marginal cost of publishing is now nearly zero. Now, this is a simple statement that is deceptive. It's the marginal cost of publication, which means the cost of printing one more publishing one more copy on top of the ones you've got there. It's not the total cost per copy, and also it's nearly zero. It's not actually zero. It's close to zero, but it's not actually zero, which means things cost a lot less, but not nothing. And nothing is an easy cost, and large cost is quite easy, but sort of small cost actually is fairly tricky. And the way this gets managed, I've talked about the cleverness on both sides of the fence, as it seems to be, and it can seem like a bit of a fight. I've done some work with our library. We had we've had terrible problems with our budget for journal subscriptions, because the e-journal subscriptions, the inflation on them year on year is double digit, which is kind of odd for an electronic thing where the costs typically fall off a cliff. We have the problem where we have to decide about our subscriptions in October, but we find out what they're actually going to cost in January, which makes our budgeting rather hard. And if I were publishers, I could sign up for that, you can charge what you like then. When we had a problem with our budgets went totally to hell when the pound slipped against the euro and the dollar, some of you working libraries all know about this. We had to try and unsubscribe and cut our subscriptions, so it was really hard because we didn't know how much they were going to cost. And actually, when we said, OK, we can do about this journal, this journal, this journal, this journal, we can't actually unsubscribe from those, they're all bundled up with lots of other things. And so it's actually very hard to unsubscribe from things. And there's also the permissions issue. Once you've had something published, I as an academic published it, I send it to the publisher, it's great. I want to use that in my course, teach my students, and actually I'm supposed to have, if I want to start doing a bit of consultancy and use my stuff as the basis for running paid-for stuff, I have to ask permissions and even pay money back to the publisher to use my own stuff, depending on the license that the publisher's had. And this isn't a totally free market. The goods aren't substitutable. The Journal of Obscure Studies isn't the same as the proceedings of the National Obscure Studies Society. You can't just say, oh, we'll have that. They are. You can't substitute one for the other, so there's not that sort of competition. And this sort of situation often gives you what a friend of mine once called a confusopoly. It's not a monopoly, because in theory you could go elsewhere, but you can't disaggregate things, you can't quite work out what you're buying, and well, you can, but it takes an awful lot of effort, and you have to employ specialist people. I'm sure your library is no different from any other that you have a whole squad of people whose job it is just to buy stuff because it's so complicated. And to illustrate, this is getting worse, not better, with electronic stuff. And there's a very striking example. There's a course that I'm involved with in my unit about e-learning and disability, actually. And we used this book by Jane Seale. It's a great book. And we built the course around this. We were trying to do innovative online stuff and build a course for very little resource using existing resources that we wanted to point to and bring them together and give the students learning experiences around those. And so we ordered this as an e-book. It was available electronically, which was another pointer, for all of our students. A few weeks into the course, and we teach at a distance, and the students on this course are across the world, which slightly makes things difficult. We can't bring them all into a room and just hand them out copies. So all electronic is great for us. We hit a problem in the first week or so because we had a limit on concurrent access to this e-book, and that was very quickly exceeded because it was something like two or three, and we had several dozen students. So we paid shed loads more to get a very expansive license, which didn't quite. There was an unlimited one, but it was really quite an astonishing sum of money. We paid for something that would cover. It was, you know, we were talking tens of thousands of pounds, It was still limited, but it was actually more than any number of students would actually get there. And there were still problems with them being able to get to it at once. So we actually paid for a single copy of a downloadable version, a PDF version of the ebook for each and every student, like a per copy version of that. So each of them would have to go through things. There was a huge administrative hassle because we were paying for it, they were downloading it, and there was all an extra layer of passwords and things to interface with any of our security stuff. When they'd finally downloaded all this stuff, and I had the electronic version of it, it was a PDF document that had digital rights management technology built into it that would only let them cut and paste a small amount of text at a time. And so we went back to the professor and said, this isn't helping. We'd gone back and forward many times. And they said, oh, well, you can't cut and paste large amounts of text. It would just be plagiarism. Why do you want people to cut and paste lots of text? Now, actually, the real problems we're having with this ebook, where students are running into this as a real issue, is because a large number of students on this course have disabilities and want to cut and paste your text from your digital rights management PDF form into their accessibility technology, the technology that reads the stuff to them or magnifies it or whatever, that your lousy ebook won't let them do. I can't remember where we actually ended up with that. It was just a terrible, sorry side of something that ought to be really very easy. And the idea that you've got a book and we know what you can do with a book, actually you don't know what you can do with an e-book. And it's very fine-grained and very nitty-gritty negotiated. And it's really not a happy experience. So that wasn't great. And it's again that because of the incongruity of incentives. The other sort of thing that can go on, in earlier this year, Elsevier were caught having produced a whole load of journals that were actually just reprints of articles. They were reasonable articles, but they were reprints of them, but they weren't badged as reprints. Perfectly reasonable to bundle up a bunch of articles and reprint them if you hold the rights, which they did. But they didn't say, they made these look like they were actual extra journals and giving them extra edit. They were paid by Merck to produce these, and what that does is make your, if you've got positive studies, and it was all selected to be positive studies for drugs that Merck were developing, that shifts the results of, when you do the analysis of sticking all of the published studies together, it shifts that to be more positive. So that's really very, very evil, but it's okay because this was an unacceptable practice and we regret that it took place, and I'm sure that nothing like it has ever happened elsewhere, that we don't know about it, and nothing like that will ever happen again, which is good, but it's a bit of a shame that this didn't blot on Elsevier's otherwise unsolid reputation. Thank you for that. You supplied me a laugh. Most of you will know about the debate about open access journals, and this is about making journal articles available online free at point of use. And there's huge amounts of argument between the two sides. both of them thinking the other side lives in cloud cuckoo land. But I think it's not. And for those of you who don't know, there's two routes to open access. The idea there's gold open access, which is there's no barriers to usage to access once it's been done. The normal way that happens is through author fees, but there are other ways of doing that. So the author pays for their article to be published, and the author might be funded by their researcher or other funders who might pay and support the dissemination of information that way. The other route is through self-archiving, which is people putting stuff into their own personal repositories, into subject-based repositories or university-based repositories or departmental repositories. And actually about something like 90% of stuff that's available as open access journals are available that way. There's a huge argument here, but I think it's really an argument of degree and about a slider on a scale. Peer review happens in all of this and is agreed widely to be important. And actually, scholars and funders pay the majority of the costs anyway for all of these, and I'll come on to this. Publishers sometimes cover some costs by charging users, readers, and that will go on as well, but that doesn't need to prevent access to the articles that way. I think it's the nature of the transaction, what's going on, is pretty clear and agreed. It's just an argument about the fee, which is, again, this incongruity of incentives. And just to sort of break down roughly what things cost, if you sort of work out how much it costs per article to publish it, roughly 55% of the cost of an article is the writing, and revisions and all the rest of it. About 15% of it is the cost of peer review, and 30% of it is publisher related. This comes from a GISC report, which wasn't uncontroversial, that came out this morning, at least amongst people who are very against open access. And people who are very pro open access and go, okay, we can get rid of all of those costs and that would be great. And I don't think we can get rid of all of those. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. I need a model to illustrate the point that I'm making here, because there's scholarly publishing. There's a whole series of steps that you can separate out. There's the writing, typically done by an academic. Then that gets submitted somewhere. There's some form of screening before it goes out to anywhere. That's typically an editor. Then it goes out for peer review. That's typically other academics, but it doesn't always have to be. It gets copy edited once it's gone. It goes back for writing and rewriting and redrafting. You can go back and forward amongst this lot for a very long time. And then finally it gets accepted by the reviewers, gets through to copy editing, all gets neatened up, and finally the references get fixed. And then it gets distributed at the end and gets sent out to everybody. And then the key activity is the project management, the chasing and following up and nagging everybody to say, why haven't you done your bit of this process, which is actually a critical bit to making the whole thing happen, because it would never happen otherwise. And if you sort of change those circles to look at sort of roughly how much those activities cost in terms of people time and stuff time,